staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
This next tune, Water So Deep, is definitely one of Guillermo's favorite songs. And I really want to do a big shout out to Desiree Harp and Cole Oak, who were the big time song writers of this song, and we did a dance, and it all came out within 9 hours of being out the base of Mount Shasta, aka Buyumpuyuk. And so enjoy this tune, and thank you to the Winnemem Wintu and all the Wintu tribes fighting for the waters.
Water so deep, water so wide, water braiding the earth and the sky. Mountains so strong, mountains so tall, lifted by spirit and holding us all. Let the mountains guide us and the waters carry our songs back to creation where we belong. When we free our voices, we free our hearts, breaking chains. Water so deep, water so wide, water braiding the earth and the sky. Mountains so strong, mountains so tall, lifted by spirit and holding us all. Salmon are returning, ancient paths in the stars. The light of life inside us is lit by the same spark. When we lose our way, think there's nowhere left to turn. Prayers are all around. We can always return. Water so deep, water so wide, water braiding the earth and the sky. Mountains so strong, mountains so tall, lifted by spirit and holding us all.
Guillermo Mash with the June 3rd, 2021 edition of Imagining Community on your people-powered community radio station, KZFR 90.1 FM. We opened our show with Water So Deep, a musical collaboration between Jesse Naomi, Desiree Harp, and Cole Oak. That is indeed one of my favorite water songs. Jesse and I shared a lot of knowledge and grace producing a special water show for KZFR that aired on Studio 416 in May. One of the more lasting comments Jesse made to me was giving thanks to covering the story of water and Run for Salmon in such a beautiful and impassioned way, and for validating that she is indeed focusing her talents and efforts in the right space. I am but a vessel to deliver the love, care, and spirit of the people, places, and things that I imagine for our community. And in this light, I see an irrefutable responsibility to share the essence of people of indigenous heritage, like Jesse Naomi, Desiree Harp, and Cole Oak, and to lift them and their message to a place of reverence and acceptance for the bountiful gifts of beauty that Native Americans bestow on us. Their underlying humility and ability to transfer knowledge to their neighbors has been a joy to cover on Imagining Community. One such joy was our next segment with Sheridan Noelani Enomoto, an indigenous woman of the Hawaiian Islands, as she shares her wisdom, care, and love for water, and Run for Salmon.
All right, Guillermo Mash here. In the element, we're here at the Redding Rancheria of the Wintu Pit River Yana Administration Building. And I'm here with Sheridan Noelani Enomoto.
You had some wonderful things to say about water. We can hear water in the background. There's this beautiful little fountain.
I'm really grateful for water. Water is definitely a teacher. And it's about learning and being humble, mm-hmm. a humble student of water, mm-hmm. and understanding that water is relationship, that we are part of our watershed, that we have waters inside of us and waters around us, and that's just not a coincidence. Mm-hmm. But I think because we are living in a world where we can't answer the question when someone says or asks you, where does your water come from? Not everyone can answer that question. If I ask you, who is your watershed, or what watershed are you a part of? Not many people can answer. But they can tell me what the brand of shoes they're wearing, or mm-hmm. clothes, or designer, mm-hmm. or what, you know, kind of. They can name mm-hmm. 10 brands, as they say, but they can't name 10 plants. And some people don't even know all the names of the oceans. So, water is definitely life. But what does that really mean? It's also about how are we living? How are we in relationship to water? How are we in relationship to life?
You had some beautiful words about going back to the source. Instead of extracting, go back to the source. Maybe you could expand on that.
Sure. So we often hear the word resource. And we think of resources, it's mm-hmm. often equated to extraction. Let's take something. Let's take a resource. Mm-hmm. But what if we rethought that word as, and thinking of the word resource as a reminder to return to source?
Mm-hmm. How does that relate into your background with cultural studies and the people that live and rely on the water, like the Winanim Wintu and the Run for Salmon that you're part of?
The reason why I was interested in cultural studies, before that I actually created my major in race and ethnic studies mm-hmm. as an undergrad and moved into cultural studies. But the truth is, these studies are really about a way of life, mm-hmm. about life ways. And why do people do what they do? Why do we live the way we do? That's what those kinds of studies ask. And I was just really curious. I'm really grateful that being Kanaka Maoli or Native Hawaiian, in that view, in that form of understanding and Hawaiian wisdom or having Hawaiian ancestry, also has informed me about understanding watersheds. Mm-hmm. In Hawaii, the islands were often, or villages were often, organized around ahupua'a, or a watershed system. And everyone had a role along their watershed, from the mountain to the sea, everything in between. There was always in relationship to a watershed. I feel that the Run for Salmon specifically is about that. It's about understanding one of the main, if not the watershed of California that feeds, or does at least has some sort of connection or source to all of the waters that feed California. In most of the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And being a part of the Run for Salmon, being at the source, being on the journey for mm-hmm. over 300 miles, whether you're going from the bay in the North Bay all the way up to Buyumpuyuk or Mount Shasta, or vice versa, from the mountain to the sea, when we're following the salmon understand water too. Mm-hmm. They are in relationship to water. They understand there's a whole relationship. They're part of a relationship, series of relationships. The temperature of the water, the when the water is moving, the seasons of water. And then the way that water also interacts with the flora and the fauna and other forms of life and animals, that minerally rich quality water exists because of all of these relationships. And so the Run for Salmon really brings together the watershed way of living of relationships. Mm-hmm. And that essentially is life. It's the life that also exists within us, in our bodies. Mm-hmm. So it's one huge reciprocal relationship of understanding. And yeah, if you want to learn about a way to navigate the world or to move or to understand why people do what they do or a life way, I want to do a watershed way of living. And the Run for Salmon has been such a gift for that, such a huge teacher. And I'm really grateful. It also transformed my life personally. 6 years later, here I am.
You're trying to do it for the TV audience that can't see you, but you had so much emotion. You had like passion and reverence and excitement and demur. You had so much emotion as you talked about water. Why do you think that is?
This was a great question. They say that water, when you dream of water, when you have water, or when water comes up, it actually is emotion. It almost equates to energy in motion, which I think speaks to the way water moves. Water is always moving. Yeah. It's transformative. It kind of is a great mirror of energy moving within us. And it's not stagnant, or at least healthy water is not stagnant. Or we learn from stagnant water as well, that when we're stagnant within when our emotions are stagnant, when we go into sort of a depression, what does that teach us, you know, emotionally? Energy, emotion, or maybe we should say, what is the water in that?
Any closing comments, Sheridan?
Olai kawai. In Hawaiian, that would translate into English as water is life, but it's also an irreplaceable wealth. It's a life spring of creation that we should not take for granted.
Thank you. That was beautiful.
Mahalo. Thank you for spending time with me in front of this water.
That last segment. Oh, that last segment. Beautiful. But Sheridan Noelani Enomoto with a stunning personal testimony to water that moved me more than any single snippet I have gathered during my 6 months of covering water, Imagining Communities 2021 featured topic. I thought of my dear friend Jim Brobeck, water policy analyst with AquaAlliance.net, during and after this humbling conversation with Sheridan, and dedicate this segment to him and AquaAlliance.net. Here's the song Flow by Jim Brobeck, as recorded by Imagining Community next to a vernal pool in Sycamore Channel back in February, here on Peak Power Radio.
Catch a ripe river, hitchhike with your boat, paddle to the current, move with the flow, won't feel rhythm, river, rhythm. I wanna feel that flow, feel the river flow. And though it seems bold, I wanna be the flow, be the river flow. Feel that flow, feel the ocean flow. And though it seems bold, I wanna be that flow, be the ocean flow.
Imagining Community is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner to the California Arts Council since 2001. Friends of the Arts creates economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and by publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. Also made possible by Dahlmeier Insurance Agency, an independent agent and retail broker since 1948. Dahlmeier Insurance provides a range of coverage options from home and auto insurance to farm and ranch coverage. You can reach Dahlmeier Insurance in Chico at 342-6421 and in Oroville at 533-3424. or at chicoinsurance.com. All right, Guillermo Mash, Imagining Community, live, not dead, live. On the microphone at KZFR 90.1 FM, your community radio station for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. You know, I'm realizing I have my mask on, and there's no one in the room, so I'm going to take that off so I don't sound as muffled as I probably sound. All right, here's my maskless, unmuffled sound. I like that better. Imagine Community, grassroots media and civic engagement endeavor, sharing stories that make our collective imaginations sparkle and engage. Imagining Community has a presence on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram, with an audio podcast available on Spotify and all major podcasting platforms. We've mentioned Run for Salmon several times tonight. Yeah, much love. Runs to Salmon. And Run for Salmon is a prayerful journey led by Chief Kalleen Sisk of the Winnum and Wintu tribe to restore our salmon runs, protect our waters, and our indigenous life ways. More info at runforsalmon.org, because they're going to do a much better job on that website of connecting you to Native Way, Salmon Way, Waterway. Gosh, love Run for Salmon and all of our indigenous friends. And stay tuned for our solutions-based interview with Alan Hawthorne that follows our lead-in, this lead-in, dedicated to the wisdom, care, and love of indigenous community members. Our love for the indigenous story started at Imagining Community's very first season from November 2019 to March of 2020, pre-COVID, the good old days, covering Native American culture, Native American genocide, and traditional ecological knowledge. It was at an Imagining Community event at Blackbird. Huh? Love our Blackbird. Hope you're back with a space soon. That changed my life's perception or lack thereof of the indisputable horrors of genocide that in this state included a bounty back in the gold rush days. It was during the showing of the Canary Effect, whose tagline is "Kill the Indian, save the man," from a popular 19th century poster to a full house of diverse community members, that the horrors of colonization and the genocide of the Native American population throughout the United States sunk in deep. The guest speaker, Allie Meadows Knight, with the Mechoopter tribe of Butte County, drove home the travesty of the times that continues to this day in new forms of racism and gentrification dedicated to silencing the voices of the indigenous. Not here at Imagining Community, not here at KZFR 90.1 FM, ain't gonna happen. The season-long coverage and a recent coverage of fire and prescribed burns, you know, one of them was I did a couple with Zeke Lunder, a fire landscape expert, fire manager, just all things fire. We actually did an interview that strung to the CNR's radio show, and a really neat Imagining Community segment that Zeke at Alan Hawthorne's Overlook for Butte, Friends of Butte Creek up in Helltown. But anyway, all of that cemented the need to lift the voices of Native American media, such as Native People's Magazine, which I got at Blackbird Books. Blackbird, we love you. And news from NativeCalifornia.com, and also the Karuk, K-U-R-U-K. Right, say that again, write that down, K-U-R-U-K Media, who I learned about at another Imagining Community movie showing of We're Caring for Our World, also shown at Blackbird with guest speaker Allie Meadows Knight. Allie's post-movie showing commentary moistened every eye in the audience, including herself, as she shared her connection with the tribe where she bore a child. It's the finest mini-docu I have seen on fire, Native culture, and the devastating effects to the tribe by the European colonizers. I get emotional actually thinking back to the whole event, both of those events. And I just so much love for the Mechoopter. There's a lot of Mechoopter members that were in the audience, and just, yeah, some of the most amazing events I've attended at Chico, and just love for Blackbird for hosting, and Allie Meadows Knight and all of her friends for making it all possible. And the Karuk Media, Karuk, K-U-R-U-K, Media. Looking back 18 months later, I'm tremendously grateful for the experience afforded to me by the Mechoopta tribe and the Winnum and Wintu to spread their story of love, care, and wisdom for their community and for their beloved environment shaped and born by fire and water. To that end, let's take a listen to the audio portion of Carrying the Torch: Klamath River Treks a recent video by Kurukh Media, which can be found on Vimeo as K-U-R-U-K Media or tinyurl.com, K-U-R-U-K Media. Here we go. Got to reach over to do this, so we might have like a little bit of silence.
Imagine doing this a long time ago with just a stick, you know, lighting it off. It'd be something else to experience, that's for sure.
I'm Alex Watts-Tobin, the Kurukh Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, and the people that I work with are the acknowledged experts in the use of cultural fire.
As a living culture, you know, we're still living within our cultural landscape, our cultural places. So people are still visiting, you know, their gathering areas, like in the places that their families have always been. And so, you know, one missing element is that we're not able to burn them like we have in the past.
Prescribed fire is putting fire on the ground in the right place, with the right people and equipment, at the right season of the year and the right time of day. Wildfire is none of these things. Cultural fire is doing these things in a traditional way and as part of a sacred ceremony.
I think one of the important things about the work that we do is that it highlights how connected we as Indigenous people are to our place, when we still have this really strong connection with like the way that the ecosystem is kind of changing, and we're very like on the pulse of that because of the way that we live.
Our team runs cultural surveys both to inventory historic places and to inform management prescriptions for fire. Imagine finding a castle in the woods. We do that every day, only in our case it's tan oak groves and bear grass patches and woodwardia patches that are found in specific locations and particular combinations across the landscape that show ancestral management of the land.
It's obviously better to be able to plan fire, to be able to implement a plan rather than respond to these disaster emergencies like we have been. It's safer, you know, talking about sending crews of people, you know, paying them to get ahead of things and to create, to work in environments, to do surveys, to do like fields work in a lot safer conditions than to send all these crews out into wildfire situations.
So I am number 1812 on this fire, which means I'm the 1812th person to be hired to work on this fire in the overhead capacity. So it's rather arresting to think that in a place like this is where ancestral people would have lit a fire just by a sugar pine and an oak tree here on the ridge, and maybe half a dozen or less people could have burned off this whole watershed here if it had been in condition. But since it's in this position right now, this condition of fire suppression over a long time, it takes so many people and so much equipment and resources to fight fires around here.
We're talking about creating safer, fire-safe places, but we're also talking about encouraging Indigenous sovereignty and encouraging like continuance of, you know, food systems for food security. We're talking about mental health for the people, and so it's all of that. Talking about the health of the plants and the animals in those places. So obviously when we have these huge disaster fires, it's not benefiting like watersheds and ecosystems, you know, plants, animals, and people's gathering places are burning up and homes are burning down. So it's not benefiting any of those things generally. You know, just talking about the recent fire in Happy Camp, there's like very burned areas, tribal areas, you know, tribal homes. And so that's not what we're trying to create. And I think that with a lot of prescribed fire efforts on the large scale, you're going to see a lot safer communities, you know, from these disastrous wildfires, and you're going to encourage communities to have access and ability to manage their gathering areas and, you know, continue to feed the people. And you're going to see a lot of wildlife and plants, you know, creating their own space within this diversity of the ecosystem. So I think that that's what we're trying to create.
To do prescribed fire in the right way, we need partnerships and cooperation from government agencies that administer the land. And we need community buy-in, outreach and education, including plays that dramatize the ancient stories that continue to teach today's people how to set the world back right.
All right. What we just aired was Karuk Climate Heritage with a snippet of the track's video by Karuk Media at Vimeo. I miss... this thing's continuing to play. Hold on.
Oh, that stupid kid. Get out of the
doctor. Do everything. Answer the door. Make the coffee. But I misspoke the lead-in for Karuk Media. That's K-A-R-U-K. Media at Vimeo. K-A-R-U-K. Media. You need to check them out. Wonderful work. Wonderful work. Next up, Alan Hawthorne with Friends of Butte Creek, as recorded on his outdoor patio at his West Sacramento farm in Chico, here on People Powered Radio. Guillermo Maggio reporting for Imagining Community, and I'm really pleased to be doing a follow-up interview out here on his farm with Alan Hawthorne out here on West Sacramento in Chico, California. Welcome to KZFR and Imagining Community, Alan Hawthorne.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure, Guillermo.
Same here, Alan. And I know it was a wonderful just going over to your booth there at the farmer's market and your Oh My God, OMG Juice, right? OMG Juice. And
yep, That's the name. The customers named it.
Yeah, it is really good. But it was just fun to connect with you around this story of Friends of Butte Creek and the watershed of Butte Creek and the salmon runs and all the things it entails. But today we're going to be talking with Alan more about solutions. And Alan's going to jump in here in just a second and talk about the three main points that Butte Creek, Friends of Butte Creek, is working on, and maybe, you know, some of the solutions that our listeners or folks might want to get involved in. So maybe start with the first one, Alan, and we'll get rolling here.
Well, this is actually a really good year to be talking about this, because we have a fabulous run of salmon, despite the dire situation with most of the other salmon runs in Northern California. Butte Creek is just kicking them out again. It's not unusual to have more than 10 to 15,000 fish, but this looks like it could be a real record buster this year. As you can imagine, water is going to be a very limiting factor this year. And for the spring run salmon, every little bit of holding habitat is going to be packed full of fish, that's for sure. Hopefully we'll stay cool enough that we don't have a lot of pre-spawn mortality. But with this number of fish, I just don't know how they're going to fit in all the habitat that we have. So the first thing that we have been trying to address for many, many years, and this goes back to actually Fish and Game's wishes back in the early 1980s, and that is to get fish up above Centerville Head Dam and up into the canyon, below Butte Meadows, potentially all the way to Butte Meadows if the engineering were undertaken. It would be a spectacular habit for spring run, exactly what made them such a famous run, and it's not that big a chore to open that habitat up. There are discussions of trucking fish around dams and up into tributaries above dams. And it just seems crazy to me that people would go to that extent when, in fact, you have an opportunity here to do it on a natural stream that almost certainly had salmon and steelhead all the way up to its headwaters before the Europeans showed up.
What do you got in the works, Friends of Butte Creek? What kind of plans, projects are you working on to get that upper watershed habitat ready for the salmon?
Essentially, we are in limbo at this point because PG&E controls the waters in that area. They operate a small hydroelectric project called the DeSable-Centerville Project, and they divert water out of Upper Butte Creek, mix it with water that they bring over from the west branch of the Feather River, and then run it through DeSable Reservoir and down through DeSable Powerhouse. So they control much of the water that is would be available for salmon habitat up in those reaches. So that's a bit of a problem. The positive side is that the project, as it's been operated, is a huge money loser. PG&E is trying to sell it. It's having a tough time selling this project. It's old, aged, falling apart in places. The Centerville portion of the project is virtually dead. It's been offline for going on 10 years now. And we just don't know what the outcome of this potential sale might be. If they can't come to agreement with a buyer, then PG&E is obligated under the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to decommission the project. Exactly what that would look like, nobody knows. A project of this size hasn't been decommissioned in recent history, so it would be quite a challenge.
Do they have water rights at all, Alan? I mean, as far as being able to divert water, or do they just kind of use the water to generate electricity? You know, what kind of rules and regs are they under as far as the distribution of water past that those dams?
They have water rights to Upper Butte Creek at all of their diversion points. They have you know, complete legal water rights, some of them going back pre-14, as they say. And they never divert above that. It's all gauged and monitored, and half the time their facilities don't even allow them to operate at full capacity because they're falling apart. Each of the dams has a different diversion rate, and they all have basically the same season ranking. Is it a dry season, extremely dry season, you know, normal, wet, very wet? And with minimum flow regulations, if you have normal to wet years, then you have so much that's left in the creek. If you have very dry conditions, then you're allowed to take a little higher percentage and leave a little less in the creek. All of that would have to go away to make the salmon habitat useful for spring run. So
in summary, the sale of these two dams would include not just the infrastructure, but the water rights as well?
Yes, it would.
Shifting to the other end of the creek, I know you talked, that was one of your main goals for Friends of Butte Creek was the upper watershed, but enlighten our listeners on what's going on in the lower watershed and what kind of things that Friends of Butte Creek would like to see for that part of the water.
Well, we'll move downstream in the natural flow here and address the area where the salmon are today. And essentially from below the Centerville Head Dam down into the valley, and for all we know, there are still fish coming up the Sacramento River headed for Butte Creek. But very little habitat restoration has taken place along the main stem of Butte Creek. I'm most interested in the canyon area because that's where the spring run salmon spend their summers. That's where most of them spawn and where most of the juveniles start their rearing process. And one of the unfortunate situations on Butte Creek is that most of the habitat in this upper reach area is leftovers of the gold mining dredger tailings. And in some places, they were leveled and divided into home lots. Other areas, they're still just piles and pits and lakes and levees that, you know, fall apart with, you know, high flows and huge dredger ponds. Really not the best of juvenile salmon rearing habitat, really not the best spawning habitat. Very poor floodplain function. And by that I mean floodwater retention, allowing the floodwaters to spread out across the landscape and soak in. There are other vegetation complexes that are much better for a riverine corridor like that. On top of the tailing piles, you have a whole lot of dry vegetation because they're just not connected to the water. And this gets to the whole issue of fire. We've seen two significant fires sweep through this area in the lower canyon in the last 12 years, and both of them just took off as they crossed the canyon, partly because this vegetation is not natural. It's very dry, and during fire season, it's highly ignitable. And one fire, you know, jumped Butte Creek and went to Paradise. The other one jumped Butte Creek and went to Chico. So it's an opportunity to try and recreate a riparian forest with nice riparian juvenile rearing habitat and floodwater retention areas. And hopefully it'll become something of a fire break rather than a spark that blows it up and out of the canyon.
Now, listeners just joining, you're listening to Alan Hawthorne here on Imagining Community, and Alan is with Friends of Butte Creek. Now back to the interview. Salmon restoration, does that include the water habitat as well, the flowing part of the water? Would you get in there and dredge it and kind of relay that out, or are we just talking most about riparia? I mean, maybe talk a little bit about what restoration is.
Well, when it comes to restoration on mining tailing areas, and there's actually quite a bit of information on this if you're really interested. It's been done on the Salmon River, which is a tributary to the Klamath. The Trinity River has extensive mine tailing restoration projects. Clear Creek outside of Redding is another one that has some wonderful projects that have recreated the natural floodplain. And then the real big one that's taking place right now is on the Yuba River. Most people have heard of the Yuba gold fields. Well, that's really just the leftover wreckage of a dredging mining operation that bailed out and probably gave the land to somebody else and left it a mess. So they're doing stuff like this on the Feather, too. I mean, we've all seen the big tailing piles and tailing ponds along the Feather River. It's pretty much the same thing. And in most cases, it's a matter of pulling the banks back, because when you're, a creek is just flowing through old tailings, it's cutting the easiest channel it can. There's very little meander, usually. You don't have point bars. You don't have eroding banks. You're just running through cobble, and it's like, you know, a wall of marbles on either side. So getting those back off of the creek area, like I said, allowing some floodwaters to expand out onto the floodplain a little bit, deposit some soil, allow that riparian vegetation to come back, are all things that, you know, would make that habitat significantly better for not just salmon, but steelhead, of course, as well, but all of the other things that depend on them, the western pond turtle, foothill yellow-legged frog. That's the kind of habitat that they really love.
You know, maybe some insight on, you know, what is going on as far as habitat restoration on Butte Creek, you know, right now, or anything in the works.
Well, I wish I could give you some really positive news, but Friends of Butte Creek has been applying for grants to various agencies through Prop 1 and 68, the Wildlife Conservation Board, Cal Fish and Wildlife. And so far, we haven't received any of the restoration grants. Generally, in this arena, it often takes 2 to 3 years, sometimes even longer, to develop the relationships and the partnerships with the agency people, the private landowners, and people knowledgeable in restoration planning and restoration implementation. So we figure, we've only been doing it for a little over a year now, so probably within the next year or two we'll start to see some action. Mm-hmm. We're trying to build up our relationships with various agencies and let them know what we're proposing to do and get feedback from them about, how best to go about doing this. The thing that, I'll get back to about this restoration work is it's something that the more fish you have in the stream, the more habitat you need to rear those fish. Right. Mm-hmm. And one thing that we have learned about Butte Creek is they have done so well in large part because by the time they get to the Sacramento River, they've had enough time in a creek, essentially, with something of a riparian cover most of the way down through the valley. But then they go through the Butte Sink and the Butte Slough, which is a real forest, and lots of little channels here and there, and lots of food for them. And then they're diverted down the Sutter Bypass, where once again they go through a number of wildlife refuges and generally have plenty of flow to get out. But the most important thing is they have plenty of food. So when they reach the end of the Sutter Bypass and enter the Sacramento River at the mouth of the Feather River, they're the biggest, strongest spring-run salmon in the system.
What do they eat, Bob? What do these salmon eat while they're coming down the stream?
I haven't reviewed my entomology too much, but I know they start out with little things like copepods, which are like little shrimp-like creatures, I guess, really, really small, pretty, like a shellfish type of thing. And then they would start eating other larvae of macroinvertebrate insects. Mm-hmm. Butte Creek supports a tremendous number of macroinvertebrates, and they get a good start coming out of the canyon. I just can't say what it's like down in the valley. I know they're doing experiments with raising juvenile salmon in flooded rice fields and having phenomenal success. So it may be that whatever habitat they're getting into is as close to that artificial habitat in a rice field as it gets in terms of food productivity. Mm-hmm. And so the juvenile fish just get big and fat, and they're a tough bunch.
For some context of the scope, in a way, you say you've been applying for grants. I mean, how much money are we talking, Bob, and how much area? I mean, if you were looking at like a phase one or a phased approach, how many acres are we talking about, and how much money are we talking about to make a dent?
Well, probably one of the most accessible areas is in the lower canyon, and there are two ecological preserves, one owned by the Wildlife Conservation Board and one by Chico State Enterprises. And combined, it's about 380 acres of basically publicly held land. And it really is ground zero for the mining wreckage that was left behind by the previous owners. I don't know how the transition from the previous owners to Fish and Game took place or what the stipulations were, but they really didn't do much of anything to restore it to its mm-hmm. natural state. And as a result of that, there were a couple of very large tailing ponds on the upper end that were actually sold independently or held by the company and proposed for development. They were going to build condos around these little lakes and have a nice little community up there. And The Buchanan Board of Supervisors approved this project, and the residents of Butte Creek Canyon were so up in arms that they started filing petitions and were able to get the question on the Butte County ballot, and the Butte County voters overwhelmingly turned it down. The people up there care, and they realize that, you know, we're not just, you know, open for any kind of development anywhere. Mm-hmm. Ironically, 3 years later, the high water of 1986 washed out those two lakes, broke over the levee into the first lake, and the lake was very deep. So when the bank collapsed and the river essentially was going down into this big pit, it literally abandoned its old channel. The water flow in that old channel stopped. All the sediment dropped out. The bed raised up, and the creek was now running through the pond. And it broke into the second pond and then just took off down through the middle of the tailing piles the rest of the way. Mm-hmm. So it's about, you know, 200, 250 feet away from where it should be right now. Mm-hmm. And all of that area is just, it's a mess. Mm-hmm. I mean, it needs help. And then you asked about the cost. I mean, just the planning projects that we have proposed are in the $300,000 range. Implementation for something like that would be well into the millions of dollars. Just for example, I would guess on the Yuba, which is a much bigger river, much bigger project, they're probably going to spend upwards of $20 million restoring that area, and probably not all of it, but, you know, whatever they can. And I would think that, you know, on this 380 acres, you could probably do most of the required restoration for $3 to $4 million.
So have we touched upon on all the three major points of concern and solutions that you got one finger up? So it seems like we got one more. Alan, what is it?
So here again, with this tremendous run of fish we have, it's unusual to have so many fish this early. We're usually seeing, you know, kind of just off the peak of the run in May. Perhaps they understood that water was low and they had to get up here early, but we really had more fish than we've ever seen in March and April. But they continue to come, so the question is, are they going to follow their normal pattern and more fish continue to come up into June? And I've seen them in July before. And if they do, then they're going to be faced with some pretty tough water conditions right around Highway 99. So it's something we're keeping a close eye on and talking to the agencies who are working with the water diverters to try and ensure that there is adequate flows for the fish. But it's something that really needs a long-term solution. And that takes me to the grant that we have received to actually purchase a water right that was formerly diverted right there above Highway 99. And that 5 CFS of water, which we would have at this time of the year, is left in the stream and dedicated to the fish. So essentially, what we need is about 10 more of those. And that would probably be enough flow to guarantee the latest of the late spring run salmon to get up into the cooler water and the better habitat every year. And our right that we are applying for is something that would be permanent. We have discussed a number of different options that water rights holders might consider. Just short-term diversions to help the fish get up would be a big help, and there would certainly be some financial support to cover any losses that they may have by doing so. There are some diversions that could easily be converted to wells. In fact, one in particular already has a well, and would probably be just as well off without diverting water at all. A lot of things to discuss with a lot of different people to try and see what we can do to ensure that we don't have what we call pre-spawn mortalities.
Listeners just joining, you're listening to an Imagining Community interview with Alan Hawthorne with Friends of Butte Creek here on KZFR 90.1 FM.
This incredible run of spring run salmon. To the Native American people, the spring run salmon was just like sacred because it was this huge source of food that came back in the springtime and literally blessed them with its with the bounty of the ocean, no matter what stream they were on. And in our culture, salmon is looked more at as something on your dinner plate and nothing much more than that. You know, people do have, you know, their discussions over farmed versus wild fish, and that's a pretty obvious choice that wild fish is what you want to be eating, but salmon is not looked at the way it was by the Native American people, and as such, it's hard to engage the community in trying to save something like that. We have been absolutely blessed on Butte Creek to have big runs of salmon, very impressive. We've made the front page of the Chronicle before. It really helps to raise awareness of the value of these species and this run. And to me, you know, after so many years of doing this, I feel like I'm trying to re-inject salmon into our culture. And as not something just to eat, but as something sacred that's coming back to replenish the land, which is exactly what they do. And if you leave them, you know, untouched, and they're bringing back thousands and thousands of pounds of fertilizer to make our forests and our watersheds stronger and healthier. So there's just nothing like them. And, I just hope that people start to recognize them as something much more than...
Maybe closing comments, anything we might have missed or something to circle back on, Alan?
The one other element that I we have submitted a proposal for has to do with the devastation from the campfire, and it's something that most people don't look at, like Butte Creek or Little Butte Creek, the way that I do, and many of the landowners along the creek. And what we see is that the campfire really torched Little Butte Creek to the point where there's almost no live trees along the creek. And as a result, there are literally thousands of dead trees that are one by one snapping off at the top, falling over completely, and very likely going to be clogging up the stream for many, many years. It hasn't been a real issue because we haven't had any major flooding or, you know, heavy rainstorms or anything like that, but it's kind of one of those ticking time bombs that, you know, if we do have a really wet winter and we don't do something about this proactively, it could be a serious problem. I won't go any farther than that.
Okay.
But not only to fish habitat, but to human habitat, highways and things like that.
You're talking Little Butte Creek versus Butte Creek? Did I hear that right?
Yes. Little Butte Creek drains basically Paradise and Magalia. The two reservoirs up there, Paradise Lake and actually it's Paradise Reservoir and Magalia Reservoir, are both impoundments of Little Butte Creek. There's also another tributary that enters Little Butte Creek called Middle Butte Creek. Real creative names that everybody came up with. But Little Butte Creek is controlled in large part by the Paradise Irrigation District. But when their reservoirs are full and the rain keeps coming down, they have absolutely no control over what happens below the dam. So it's something that, you know, I've had my eye on for some time, and I'm hoping that I can engage with some of the agencies that might be able to help us develop a strategy to deal with that situation.
Zeke Lunder did a really nice job in a prior interview with Imagining Community describing how we're living on a fire landscape, and a lot of these creeks used to be smoke layered, which kept the heat off of the streams. And as I understand it, a lot of these salmon, most of these salmon coming back, are children of the campfire. Is that a good way to describe it, or salmon from the campfire?
Thanks for mentioning that. And yes, indeed, they are actually the campfire fish. We generally have 3-year classes of fish come back to Butte Creek, which is kind of unique in itself, but 2-year-old, 3-year-old, and 4-year-old fish. A 3-year-old fish would be one from the campfire year. They were essentially born between the 1st of November and the 1st of December. Many of them emerge from the gravel under smoky skies, no doubt. And then they were literally assaulted with runoff from burned areas, you know, throughout a good portion of the main stem of Butte Creek, and literally all of Little Butte Creek were just absolutely ash piles. Because, as I said, Little Butte Creek drains probably 2/3 to 3/4 of Paradise. So everything from Magalia comes down through there, everything up at the top of Honey Run, and really everything almost all the way over to Clark Road runs back towards Butte Creek. So it's a pretty extensive watershed and very flashy. So that rainfall can rush off that paved landscape and come down the creek pretty quickly.
That's part of it. Romantic, you know, they're thinking about the campfire and all that meant to them. I guess romance might not be what comes to some people's mind, but I'm looking at it in that vein of seeing live fish, these massive, beautiful streams of fish that really were enabled by this disaster to be so healthy. Yeah, it's a cool story.
I'll add a little bit about looking back at the history of these fish. I just happen to have learned over the last year and a half, 2 years, that there is a team of scientists from NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and some of the other agencies, and they have been analyzing a very unique component of a salmon called the otolith, which is a bone in the ear. It looks like kind of a little flat plate when they put it under a microscope. But interestingly, it has rings, much like a tree. And in those rings is a little bit of history of where the fish was at a particular point in its life. And fortunately, Butte Creek, being as prolific as it is, they have retrieved a lot of otoliths. And they have over 500 samples that they have analyzed. And they have a pretty detailed map of the life history of these fish. The other extremely interesting and really very new science that they are applying to tracking salmon is with the eyeball. So we've got the ear team and we've got the eyeball team. The eyeball of a salmon, and it may not be unique, but it sure seems like it to me, it develops sort of like the otolith, but they call it like an onion. So it's laying down layers on top of the eyeball as it moves through its life cycle. Different waters, different food sources, all of those things. And they are starting to understand how to recognize the signatures in those layers of the eyeball as to where the fish was and what the fish was eating.
Whoa.
So I had the great fortune of having some of these scientists come up and visit our salmon pool several weeks ago, and their brains were blown. They have so many ideas of how they're going to track the history of these fish and figure out what it was that made them so successful. But they are super excited about that. And I think, you know, this kind of opportunity to study something like this is another opportunity to learn what it is that makes the same.